So let's have a few questions and comments and all that.
A question I'd like to ask, my apologies for walking in late, so I may have missed this point, but quite often people say if you sort of raise the issue of surveillance, well, if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to hide, you shouldn't worry. What's your answer to that?
Well, what I say generally is you're right. If you've got nothing to hide, you do indeed have nothing to fear. But if you're a journalist and you have a source, you have something to hide. If you're a politician and you've got people, you know, constituents to talk to, you have something to hide. You have a confidentiality. If you're a business, you have confidentiality you need to hide. And in fact, anybody who might be of use to the Secret Services at some point, just happens to be in the wrong place, they too have got something to hide, because they may not want to be pushed against their will because of personal information into doing things. We all at some point need journalists, lawyers, doctors, and at those points we need our privacy. We do have something to hide. I think people forget, you know, you're always vulnerable at some point in your life. Nobody goes through life not using these kinds of services ever. You know, it's always the case that at some point you might be of interest, or you might need your own personal privacy to do things which are hard. You shouldn't just assume that the state can ride roughshod over that. I should let people ask in order.
I'm a lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University, computing department, and that is one of the statements that I hear said very often by the students. We have this debate every year with new first years coming along. We're trying to get them involved in the ethical side of computing. Before I ask my question, I just wanted to offer an open invitation. We are going to be screening Citizen 4 in a few weeks' time after Easter. So if I pass you that, I'll pass you the date on that, Mark, and if you want to let anybody know, then you're more than welcome to come along to university and watch it there. Hopefully
Fantastic.
We'll have a bit of a discussion afterwards, and you're more than welcome to come along, of course. The point I want to make there is about the politics of it. The last election, I saw probably the most excited bunch of students that I've ever seen sort of politically aware. They're not usually that bothered about politics, but coming up to the election last time, they were fired up, and then they got let down by the politicians because they lied to them about student fees and everything. So how do you expect now, or what would you suggest to try and motivate students to be politically aware again? Because it's, you know, an activated.
Well, I just think, you know, it's been... It's the balance between politicians and the public has just been completely upset. And although I think it's all very worrying. I mean, a lot of politics right now is very, very worrying. It's not all roses. Some of the things that are going on, you know, are deeply dangerous, and they play to people's fears as well. But the thing is, the other side of that is that you have more power. You know, the fact that no party is going to win an overall majority makes it completely different. And I think you only have to, you know, you can also look at things like what's happened in Scotland with the referendum, but also in the UK there's been a rise of smaller, not always unreasonable parties. You know, there are lots of things going on that say we have more power here and there's more influence. And so I think politics in Britain's going to change personally. I think it kind of it's past the point where it's sustainable. Have you got a point to make on this? Is that where your hand is kind of
So I'm the candidate for the Green Party in Glasgow, so I'd just like to point out not all parties are massive ills, and
don't listen to the public. Well, we didn't think the Dems were. I mean, it's been quite good that they got in. We thought they were the party that were going to rein everybody else in, but they just seem to be sort of popping on that same train now, don't they?
Yeah. I would say the Lib Dems have They have not been as bad on these issues as others. That's what I know. That's right. It is a degree of badness, and I think the thing is the Westminster system, it doesn't give them as much scope as they should have. It is difficult for them. They have, on the other hand, managed to not, they managed to stop the Snoopers Charter. They've done some things which are not bad. At the same time, you know, Nick Clegg is Deputy Prime Minister. I really want to know how much he knew about the whole build-up of the Snowden stuff. They've kind of got away with not having too much questions around that. I think that's very much around these whole ministerial warrants and the secrecy and so on. But, you know, they're part of a coalition that has allowed this to happen. So there is some failure there. You know, they have to take some blame. They can't just blame Theresa May for all of that. But, you know, I'll just say the system is set up to fail in that way. The IC is useless. The commissioners are under-resourced. Ministerial warrants permit everything. Where's the accountability in all that? How do you hold that accountable? They've designed it so it isn't accountable. They tell everyone that it's world-class accountability. It's not. It's a disaster. It's designed to keep it hidden. Sorry, my rant over. So, person here next.
So coming back to the result there, the big question was, so who do we vote for now there's an election coming up? Since, like, you know, we got the... We got shot of the Labour Party and their internet search and modernisation project, and now we've got the... and then that looked quite nice for a little while. Now we've got the, whatever it's called today, DIMP or MINP or something else. I don't know. I forget the names of these acronyms, okay? But yeah. Okay, so there was. So who do we vote for? We've got nobody to vote for. There's an election coming up. There's the three major parties. There's nobody to vote for, okay? And then the second thing was, okay, I'm bored of voting. Okay, I'm not interested in voting for these people. They're not going to help me out, okay, any of these major parties. When are ORG going to put together some direct action? When are we going to run some fast Tory exit notes in the UK? When are ORG going to fund this stuff and support the legal issues around these fast Tory exit notes?
Those are really good questions. So, I mean, I think I'm on Tory exit notes and so on. We really do want to work with people on that. We now have a lawyer, and we're very keen to help work out how to do those things. It would be great to get involved with that. So that's an open offer. We've got if you know people who want to do this stuff, we're really, really very, very happy to help on the legal side. And I think that's where it has to be. We shouldn't be running servers like that, because it puts the organisation in direct jeopardy. Should create legal frameworks where, you know, if they fail, it doesn't upset everything else. But again, we can help people fundraise and explain how to do that and all of the rest of those things, and most particularly just help with the legal side of things, so that you know, you are, or whoever runs these things, has the ability to do it as safely as possible, if you like. Sorry, this chap at the front.
Yeah, I wanted to essentially point at my observation, because I'm a bloody foreigner here, so I'm looking at how things work in the UK from a point of view where I come from, Austria and the continent, where things are very different, actually. So when you say the state is doing this or the state is doing that, my question would be, do you think that if actually a lot of people would be concerned about mass surveillance, that the state would do it just the same or differently? Because I think the whole opinion, or, you know, on average, the opinion about surveillance is very different here in the UK than it is in other countries. I mean, you don't need to go to digital surveillance. If I just look at, you know, every corner of the country, there are five cameras looking at me. And, you know, everybody is happy about that. It would be totally impossible in other countries, because you need to go through a very complicated procedure to just put up one camera, right? So my feeling is that in a way people are happy about surveillance, because they actually believe that stuff, that if you don't have to, if you don't do anything wrong, you don't have to fear anything. So now I think the important question is, why is this so? Why does this difference exist at all? You know, is it that people are just, you know, different, or have a different experience in their past about how these things can get abused?
Yeah.
Are they less aware about how things can get abused here than they are in other countries? I mean, my personal opinion is that it is very bad to have all this surveillance, but I think it's maybe very complicated to make a case about how bad it really is that can actually compete with all these pictures that are painted about how bad terrorism is.
Right? So, this is very interesting, and I don't think it, you know, it's kind of hard to make really definitive answers about this. I think the first thing I think is that I don't think a lot of people were upset and angry about introduction of CCTV and the way it's been introduced. I don't think it was simply a case of everyone you know, walking over. But I do think it's also quite contextual. In Britain, there's been a political climate of fear around crime, and a lot of CCTV has been pushed as an answer to another fear that people have, which is crime, which is more perhaps visceral than worries about state abuse of information and surveillance in the future. At the same time, it's also been shown that it's been fairly useless. It hasn't really reduced crime, it just pushes it around a bit. People to commit their crimes around the corner from the CCTV unless they're particularly drunk. So it might, you know, it's kind of not really doing the job that it's been, that people have been told, and people believe sometimes that it does. But I think what it has done is it has this corrosive effect that you're pointing to, that people think that, or worse perhaps, politicians think that that people are in favour of surveillance because they already accept things like CCTV. So the political balance in those people's minds is that, well, we've got away with CCTV, or CCTV has become acceptable, therefore other forms of surveillance need to be viewed purely on this pragmatic question of, do people think it helps prevent crime or not? And of course, that's not how you're meant to view your rights. You're meant to think about rights as ways to limit the actions of the state and make sure that what they do is genuinely necessary. And if you lose sight of that, you can't have this debate. And I think part of the reason we don't have that debate in the UK is because the rights framework is new. It's not really viewed as being totally British. Some people think it's a Labour invention. Other people think it's a European invention. People paying a bit more attention might notice that some British lawyers and Churchill had something to do with it. But whatever you think about that, I think, you know, the truth is that we don't, the lack of any constitutional framework and sort of acceptance of the idea of rights as a limitation among politicians and our institutional framework makes it incredibly easy for these excesses to just start occurring. So now, I'm not going to say, well, you know, what org should be campaigning for is constitutional reform or something like that. But I think we have to think about, in the longer term, we do have to think about how it is that we actually stop these abuses from occurring when they start to occur, and how we fight back at that level rather than just having everything judged on these kind of, you know, frankly muddy, pragmatic manner that we seem to do in the UK.
Just as a little follow-up, maybe, what strikes me as odd is that if my feeling is, you know, like in all the trains there are CCTVs, and in every corner there's a CCTV, my feeling is that when people actually see it, because here you are, you know, your nose is pointed at it, the fact that there is CCTV. And my feeling is there might be, on average, a feeling of, you know, a comfy feeling about this. You know, people going, stepping into a train where all these cameras are, they feel comfy. And maybe my feeling is I feel uncomfortable. You know? So the thing is, and unless you feel uncomfortable with any of this,
yeah,
you know, why should you, you know, raise it? Why should you vote for somebody who has an alternative? So
it is funny.
Really believe,
yeah,
that,
but
you should feel uncomfortable. How can we raise the issue that this is something?
Do people? So the question. So the part of the problem here is that, again, you have to look at these things in context. People do not necessarily have quite the read across that politicians tend to make. And plenty of people are uncomfortable with internet surveillance. The question is, who are they? And you see a lot of young people get angry about it or upset about it. People who use the technologies often do. The elderly people who vote, not so much.
Just on this, it's also CCTV. You have this weird thing that maybe it's good for security, but it doesn't really have an impact on most people's lives. Even when you see CCTV footage, you can't really tell who's on it most of the time because it's all kind of crap. Internet surveillance is even harder to describe because the impact on people is minimal. But when we had, for example, ID cards,
being suggested as a security measure, which are normal across most of Europe, where you might not have CCTV cameras. There was a visceral reaction. I mean, I know we've got people from the No to ID campaign here, but there was a very much public opposition to it, partially because it's not something we have a vision of. I do wonder how much of it comes down to CCTV coming in relatively slowly in shops. I mean, I remember having those big globe things in Woolworths when I was little, and them just sort of spreading out, rather than being something that's suddenly imposed, because with ID cards, it was something that was suddenly going to be a thing, or suddenly there's a backlash. And again, internet surveillance, we're at a point now where we're going, right, we want to legalise the stuff we've been doing for the last however long, and by the way, we've been collecting all this stuff, but it's okay, it's not mass surveillance. It makes it a lot harder for people to get their heads around it and to get very angry about it, at least initially, as before.
Yeah, I think all that's true. I'm going to let other people talk, though.
I want to react to the earlier speakers. That you don't have something to hide today doesn't mean that you have something to hide tomorrow. When the Germans invaded the Netherlands, they just drove through the town halls and get the books out, because in the Netherlands had registered everyone what belief they were. So they just get the town hall book and look in there who's registered as a Jew. That's as easy for them to get. So even though the government was, before the Germans came, was trustable with the information, the Germans came, so they could just use that information for their own good. And the same also goes if you are, for example, gay. There are countries where you are illegal, but it's illegal for you to be gay. If they find out the moment you travel to that country, or if you are in an allied country, that you are gay, you might end up in a lot of trouble. But the registration of those kind of information, personal information about you, can put you in danger.
Yeah, I spend most of my year with the first years, most of the time teaching them, explaining them, and to try and get them to understand that they need space, private space, to grow, like, to form their own opinions about things, without interference, without fear of self-censoring or anything like that. And eventually they do come round to seeing the importance of it, but every year, as I've seen young people coming in, 18-year-olds, all going, so what's the problem? It's just really frustrating that that's just not getting any wider. You know, the message is not getting across to the younger generation, which are the ones that are actually sharing all this information freely, and more of it, you know, the more that they interact on social media.
I think that's a conversation worth having. I mean, I think there are maybe other counterpoints to that, though. I mean, sort of young people being less inclined to use Facebook and using tools which appear to offer more privacy, for instance. Like, even the concerns in polls say that, you know, when asked, children tend to say things like privacy and bullying are more of a concern compared to, say, pornography or threats of, predatory adults. And so,
but that's not a discussion that the politicians would have with you, or the newspapers put across. You know, that might be coming through from a younger generation, but it's certainly not getting through to the adults that are actually making the decisions, is it?
Also on the point, you said that there are quite a lot of students active in politics who are very disappointed and wanted to know, maybe talk to a politician. I am quite sure that there are politicians who would like to come around and talk to them. If there is room, and you're saying, if they want to come, I can create some room for them.
Well, we have to be very careful not to favour one political party.
I think in the audience already we have two different parties, so we can have multiple parties coming if you want.
I would love to have that open debate about it, definitely, as far as the students are concerned, from the technology perspective.
I think it is really important that parties put their views forward. I think it's very important that people talk to parties about it as well. I mean, I think it's kind of the way that you challenge politicians is through the political system. You know, as much as anything, you have to do that. It is about activism within those parties. And I think part of the problem for Labour and the Conservatives is that they just simply don't have people who are active within them who are going to give any kind of counterpoint. That's part of their problem too. Chap here, I think, wanted to talk.
On CCTV, I think things might change a bit when a lot of the cameras are networked and they're linked up with face recognition and gait recognition databases.
No. Because people don't realise the problem. They aren't faced with the threat. An early example was when you have an ID card, you are forced to go to the local government and get the card with your name, and they are actually forced to face what's happening. CCTV, there's a camera hanging.
Well, so
face recognition, everything else, they don't see it.
That may be true, but it's not always been true. And I think part of the there's one example where this went terribly, terribly wrong, which I think was in, I could be wrong about this, but I think it was in Wolverhampton. It was certainly in the West Midlands. There was, this is kind of a microcosm of how all this stuff is going wrong in general right now. I think it was the Prevent programme, but it was one of the counter-terrorism, counter-extremism programmes. There's several. And the central government, UK government, funded one of the local councils to introduce networked CCTV in a particular part of the West Midlands that had a very high Muslim population. They got this grant to put this in. And somebody kind of noticed that as these cameras were about to be installed and the planning applications turned up, that these cameras were all facing the mosques and down all the streets where the mosques were, and they then went and looked at what was going on, and they said, well, look, you know, you're just trying to put the Muslim population under surveillance here, aren't you? And then they looked at where the money was coming from, and it's come from the Home Office directly to fund counter-terrorist activities and to prevent extremism. And it's like, wow, you know, like the council's telling us they're trying to prevent crime, and actually this money is all about putting Muslims under surveillance. And I think, you know, if you look a bit wider right now, it's not so much about mass surveillance, but a lot of the sort of securitization that's going on. You know, universities are being asked to report people if they, pray too much, or if they, read the wrong things, or, you know, anything that's, you know, they're meant to be telling people when people look like they might have extreme Muslim views. You know, so they're asking university lecturers to sort of profile their students and, you know, dob them in if they think they might be a risk. Now, then, you know, that's really part of the fact that the way that changes universities' cultures. What does that tell Muslims who maybe already do feel a bit upset, or who might be prone to holding extreme views? Does that make their tendencies to extreme views more moderate, or does it push them in a direction you don't want? You know, it's an incredibly divisive sort of thing that's going on, I think. And I think that's one of the really important things about surveillance. What surveillance is mistrust, right? The root of it is that you severely don't trust whoever it is that you're going to put under surveillance. And you're prepared to do that because you think there are severe risks. And when you do that on a blanket basis, or against a population or a part of the population or people with a particular viewpoint, you are persuading all of those people that they are suspicious in the eyes of the state. And that's surely not a good idea.
Yeah, I agree with that. The problem is that I have the impression that the actual majority does not. So, I mean, because I would challenge the thought that these politicians are just doing it because, you know, they want personally to do it, or, you know, for some other reason. They are doing it because they think they actually make people happy with it. And my hypothesis would be, well, yes, unfortunately, there are a lot of people who are actually happy about that. So the question then is there a good argument towards these people to show them that actually what you're doing here is disastrous? You don't want to have that, and, you know, like I just said, it's counterproductive, really. But yeah, we need to make a good argument.
I think we do. And I mean, usually, you know, the way a lot of this turns in the UK often is that you start watching it all go wrong. And once you sort of, once it starts going wrong, then people realise that they've made a mistake, and it starts rolling back. at least somewhat. And I mean, you know, so the DNA database, that was really what happened. It was, it became very obvious that it was profiling black people, that black people were ending up in the DNA database, and nobody else much was, or at least disproportionately was black people. And they got angry about it, and that helped defeat what was happening. It got defeated in the courts, of course, but there was a movement of people who felt marginalised by this practice. I think a lot of the stuff that's happening right now around sort of targeting Islamic extremists is going to have a similar effect, because it is alienating a specific community. And of course, that affects everybody once people notice, because, you know, we all have to live together. And if one part of society is basically being told that they don't fit in and they're suspicious, then that doesn't really work for anyone. So I think, unfortunately, in the UK, it does work that way. You have to find you have to find the problem and point it out, because the judgments are far too pragmatic, and they're not. There's not enough of an element of principle and worry about the kind of structure of the action. It's just, well, does it work or doesn't it? And that's why they fall into these traps. They're not thinking on the wider level. And as you say, part of that is because you just haven't had the sort of experience of systemic failure of the state for a very long time. I won't say, as some would do, you know, that we haven't had oppression since Cromwell or anything. I mean, we've had plenty of it. But we haven't had it to the same degree or intensity as other countries, I think, is a more accurate way to put it.
One of the things I think about when trying to come up with arguments against surveillance is look at where it fails because people rely on it too much. Tragic events like a small lad was hit by a police car and died. And the reason the police car was speeding was because it was going to capture a car who had been flagged up by an NPR camera. It turned out the flag on the NPR camera system was nothing more than a trivial log that someone had made, and yet, without finding out what that flag was, the central police car to intercept it, the entity racing through the streets killed somebody. So over reliance on surveillance, and also some comments from the CIA saying that if the CIA hadn't been relying so much on signals intelligence and they kept more of their human intelligence, that they would have spotted the threat, the ISIS threat earlier. The signals intelligence wasn't there to pick that up, and that's something that an ex-CIA agent said was speaking to papers in America.
I think that's a really good point. As I said, that speaks to this whole question of how much money is going on GCHQ. We're spending, I'm pretty sure it's about 80% of our intelligence money goes to GCHQ compared to, you know, the rest of the 20% left goes to the human intelligence part of it. That's really labour intensive, and I think probably ought to be getting more money, but it isn't. And there is a danger there. You know, if you're just producing lots and lots of digital intelligence and finding new techniques of breaking into more computers and systems globally, you know, is that really dealing with your threat?
Just back on what Andrew was saying, and also what you're saying about things having an impact on your life. I've always had a bit of a thing about not wanting to be photographed, and this has caused me all kinds of upset with various people. And a particular friend of mine could just never really understand it. Then one day we found out about televisions, the Samsung Smart TV. And we were talking about it one day, and he's, to his absolute credit, at no point did he just go, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know, like you were totally wrong, and I was totally right about this." He did say, I understand now what you mean, because the idea of having a television that could listen to him had an impact on his life. Immediately he could see it, and then suddenly went, right, I understand what your problem has been all this time. And so, yeah, it's finding that way to say, well, this is actually how it impacts you. This is how it affects you. And, yeah, so just keep at it, I guess. Keep talking to people.
Isn't this why we use, like, avatars online and, like, nicknames and stuff, because we don't know?
Well, that's a different thing, really. I mean, it's a related thing. I think it's probably a bit
More comments here?
Going back to the thing about people saying they've got nothing to hide. I mean, I think generally that's true. Most people actually don't have much to hide because most people aren't involved with organising illegal wars, they're not involved with money laundering, they're not involved with, you know, massive international drug trading. You know, they're not doing all the kind of illegal stuff that the people at the top of the hierarchy are. The people at the bottom of in the middle of the hierarchy aren't actually doing all the stuff that they want to keep. You know, they're the people. It's the people at the top that have the most to hide, because they're the ones that are, you know, ensuring that we have a global system that's, you know, causing climate change, burning all the fossil fuels, wiping out, you know, most other species. You know, in the last 50 years, half of the living things on the planet have been killed, etc., etc. You know, thing out came out today. I was listening to On Democracy Now earlier. They reckon at least between 1 and 2 million people have been killed in the wars of terror, you know, in Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on. And, you know, most normal people aren't doing these things. And I think the reason they are using mass surveillance is because basically the people at the top of the hierarchy are frightened of the rest of us because, you know, collectively, the rest of us together could potentially change this global hierarchical system. And that's what they're really afraid of. And
without wanting to kind of totally jump down the conspiracy sort of thing, I will agree to this to a certain extent, because the polling shows that the people who trust the surveillance stuff the most are the people at the top of the hierarchy, and the people who trust it the least are at the bottom. So it does tell you that at least psychologically there is, you know, something in what you're saying. You know, the people at the top think they have the most to gain from surveillance, and the people at the bottom feel they have the most to fear.
Well, it happens all in democracies. It's not like it would be dictatorships. We are all responsible for the people on the top. We could change it. Everybody could vote for the Greens. I don't know.
Life is complicated, and I don't want to suggest that we're all powerless or anything like that. But I do think there is a There is something in this relationship between surveillance and trust, and why trust it or not. And I mean, again, I kind of ask when you're asking why does Britain put up with all this? I think there is something also in the way that the establishment manages to push out its own views on these things. It is very, very good at persuading people, particularly around security and law and order, that their interests are, you know, that we have to do this. And this is important for national interests, if you like. They're quite good at that.
Yeah. Yeah, do we actually really know that everybody approves of all the CCTV? It's not like we've done a survey of, you know, a census. It's never been a question on, like, the 2011 census or the people.
Do you really approve protests? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you could just say no.
Cars and speeding and things like that. If they used to catch speeding motorists, then everybody protests.
Yeah,
it's
not like people would never say no to something. You just don't say no to this damn surveillance cameras, and they don't say no to the CHQ.
It would be nice to have, like, had our permission. You know, I'm like, well, okay, you can watch me walk down the street or whatever, but I'm not quite happy that you're watching what I'm doing at home. Like data being transmitted from maybe my computer on the internet or things like that. Actually, like, I don't want people to feel.
I mean, they still wouldn't want surveillance cameras on the loo or in the bedroom, I think. I don't know.
Hogan Howe
don't do anything illegal.
Hogan Howe from the Met did suggest that people install CCTV in their living rooms. Only a week or two ago.
Solve crimes much more quickly. Did you suggest that there had to be a head
hunt
as well?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Fantastic. We've got three people with hands up, so quickly, yourself.
Regarding the needles and the haystacks, I'm putting that to Mark over there, there was a couple of articles in the journals of the American Mathematical Society, and I'm a mathematician another day. After 9/11, okay, there was a huge push in the United States to store and grab lots and lots of data, okay. And they enlisted help from lots of really, really fucking smart people to help them deal with all the data that they've got there, okay? But just recently, in the last 6 months, okay, in the AMS, the Journals of the American Mathematical Society, two of the key mathematicians involved in the analysis of the data after 9/11 and all this looking for those needles in that haystack, put their hands up and said, like, you know, we're really struggling to do this. With this big data problem defeating us, okay? And, like, chucking more hay onto this haystack, okay, is not helping us at the moment, okay? And that's coming from the smart people who, like, fucking smart people who know their stuff, okay? And I forget the names of the two mathematicians, sadly, I can't remember the names, okay? But it's in the Journals of the American Mathematical Society, so I found that was quite a useful data point, you know, as you
go into this kind of stuff, yeah. I think it's interesting, and I don't want to kind of claim that I know the answer on this at all, but Bruce Schneier, for instance, over the years has sort of pushed forward this idea that you have a basic problem that if you cast the net too tightly and you do get good matches, you inevitably miss the suspects that you didn't really know about.
Mm.
Whereas if you cast it too widely, then you just end up with too much dross. You do catch most or all of the people that you need to catch, but you also end up with thousands and thousands of irrelevant matches. So, you know, that's kind of base rate fallacy is, I think, the mathematical term for this, is a problem of, that if you are trying to, if you profile people accurately, you know, you miss it, and if you get it so that it catches everyone, and because your data, you know, your sample size is too big, you end up with too many results, basically.
I think my point was, really, there were some people who are actually engaged in working with the NSA, trying to develop systems and tools that would actually be really useful to them, and they decided that actually hoovering everything wasn't really very good, wasn't a very good solution to their problem, you know.
I think that's fascinating, and we should look and see what they said exactly.
Yeah,
that's fascinating. So, chop it back.
It does seem two things come out of what has been said. One is that there will be innocent victims. And the wider you cast the net, to use your metaphor, the more innocent victims there will be. Pretty Orwellian sort of seeing that. And the other is that this system is set up to fail. It's one of those extraordinary situations. It's not hard to see how, if you're an intelligent terrorist and wanted to avoid getting on lists, it's not rocket science. So what you're doing is, in the words of the old advert for bleach, you know, kills 99% of all known germs. Yes, what about the 1% that you don't kill? No, they're the people to watch, really, in a sense, if you're going to look at it from that sort of security angle. It just seems like a system that is set up to fail.
And I think that goes to the basic question of oversight. There was when Rifkind, Rifkind and Bleers asked the civil liberties groups. Thankfully, not all, because it happens. But they asked Liberty and Front Watch and Privacy International. Mm-hmm. You know, are deaths the price that you know, are terrorist incidents and deaths a price worth paying for people's privacy? And they said, well, yes, but you've got to kind of think this through. And they tried to explain why you ultimately are prepared to pay a price. But of course, what that doesn't tell you is that's already what we're doing. We don't live in a perfect surveillance state where everything is known and all risks are quantified. We live in a state where, because the security budget is, you know, £1.5 billion or whatever it happens to be, there are limited resources that are applied and the state accepts some risks and not others. And what oversight needs to do is ask itself whether those risks are the right risks to run and whether those risks are, you know, have unacceptable consequences, and just understand the environment that they're operating in. But GCHQ is undoubtedly deciding not to do certain investigations, which they know full well might result in deaths. that's their job, is to decide which risks they run and which they don't. And, you know, Rifkind trying to put that onto privacy groups who are not charged with oversight of the agencies, you know, is pretty pathetic when actually he's failing, or that committee, the ISC, is failing to do the job at all of examining the risks that they are running. They don't do that. They've been looking at it from a legal perspective. They do not sit there asking whether the risk calculations are the right ones. So I'm pretty appalled by that.
But I think maybe that's even one of the most important points here, because, as you pointed out, nobody surveils the surveillers. And, I mean, so that makes it completely impossible to have a fact-based discussion about how effective... I mean, we don't even know how many things they might have prevented, if at all. Yeah. Maybe they don't. Maybe they have not prevented a single one. Maybe they have prevented 1,000. I don't know. Nobody
the idea
knows.
Is that you can watch something happen and intercept it, and by the time that's happened, it's too late. The incident has occurred, or event.
It seems clear that you just now know
that it happened, as opposed to not knowing.
I mean, my point is, you don't know anything about what's going on, and as a citizen, if you're happy,
yeah.
I mean, even if you say I'm happy with surveillance, I want to know about what am I happy. You know, but I don't even know that, because I don't know what's going on, right?
We would aid the terrorists for you to know.
Sorry?
Who would aid terrorists for you to know? That's the argument. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, that it is the core of it. We don't, by having an ineffective oversight regime designed to be ineffective, we're denied the information, therefore we can't have a debate, and therefore assertions that your privacy must be sacrificed for our survival or whatever it happens to be become easy to make, because there's no proper rebuttal. No, the evidence doesn't say that. You can't do that because we are denied the evidence. At least in America, they are looking at the evidence. They require the evidence. And they've been looking at this, you know, how many incidents might have been prevented. I think they found maybe one. You know, put that against the budget and the scale of this. Is that a price worth paying? I don't think it doesn't really seem like it is. I should ask the lady behind if she wants to say something. She had her hand up.
I actually wanted to kind of go off topic a little bit, talk about the Union Supers Charter that you mentioned. Do you think that, given the experience that some other European countries have had about surveillance, particularly Germany, I would imagine, around the Second World War, and how active some of the people there are against surveillance, do you think that's going to help repeal things in the UK if it did go ahead, or do you think it would be?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I think ultimately there's going to be a big clash between the UK and if you like European structures of one sort or another, and you kind of see this brewing at the moment. Austria and some colleagues in Ireland both challenged the data retention regime. And the data retention is, you know, mild compared to the Snoopers Charter. Snoopers Charter is like what GCHQ are doing, but we give it to the police. Mm. You know, that's what that's about. You know, gather everything and let them search it all. The data retention, relatively speaking, is quite a small thing. You know, it's keeping records that are already created for a certain length of time for the police. But the European Court of Justice, the European Union, said that that's not reasonable. You have to do this on the basis of suspicion. You've got to have reasons for doing it. You've got to apply it to specific circumstances. It was basically an argument for data preservation rather than blanket retention. The UK government just sidestepped it. Said, it's all right. We'll make it compliant. We'll just reenact the same thing all over again. That'll be okay because we have better laws than they did in Europe. So, you know, that means it's going to be fine and proportionate.
Because I can't help but think that it's going to sort of help our case, really, if they did go ahead and have that debate in Europe. However, I don't know how people would feel about it with the rise of UKIP at the moment. It might just push us further away from Europe.
Well, there is a clash going on.
On the data surveillance in the Netherlands, when the judge made that ruling, we had a minister of security push out from, oh, we just changed the law and make it, keep it legal. And he's now being sacked and someone else stepped in. He told all the providers to delete all the data and they're now having an argument from, okay, should we again introduce the law? And today they had an argument about it and the Minister of Security came up and said, well, I can't give you any data on how effective it is. Three of the major parties said, oh, well, we're fine with it. Even if there's no data on how effective it is, we are still going to support this law.
In Austria, this was abandoned. I think it was the second.
Has there been a crime wave in Austria?
We had actually data about how effective it was.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was intended for terrorists and severe crimes, and actually what they did is catch a couple of, you know, drug dealers, small ones, you know, and that was it. So there was no effectiveness with regard to what it was intended to do whatsoever. So we have the hard data about
it. So in the UK, what goes on is a lot of requests, and I think for user data and for phone records, is not clear how much of that would exist anyway. You know, you think of mobile providers, they keep these things forever just because people seem to like having, you know, be able to check their phone bills from 5 years ago. So, you know, that...
But you can have a law that they have to destroy it, right?
Well, there's lots of things you could have, but, I mean, it's kind of user choice, ultimately. I mean, users should...
It hasn't been Austria, actually.
Okay, but whatever... The bottom line is they get hold of this data and they use it. They use it because it's there. It's there partly because of data retention, but also because of what companies do. Is how much of this is, you know, what is going on here? You know, it's kind of, there's some danger that this is kind of easy and cheap for the police compared to other sorts of investigation. But how, I don't think it really necessarily means you get more crime solved because these crimes are insoluble. It might be sometimes true, and you can point to some extreme examples, like for instance when you get records of people accessing child abuse image sites, and you get historic records, and the, you know, IP addresses are nearly 12 months old, and therefore, you know, you can see that data retention might, in some of these extreme cases, solve crimes which would be hard to otherwise. The thing is that does that make the whole thing justifiable, and does it mean that those individuals couldn't be caught by other means and other kinds of investigation in the medium term? And meanwhile, all the things that you're claiming you really are using it, how many of those really, really are relying on data retention as opposed to other investigations? I mean, most police officers will tell you that investigations are a mosaic. They're not solved by a single fact or single method. It is many methods and facts that they use in order to find a way to their result. So removing or not having one kind of surveillance power does not mean crimes become insoluble. It means that their investigatory techniques have to adjust. And again, if you look at sort of practice across Europe, you see some that, you know, Poland, for instance, the UK, have huge amounts of data requests, and other countries seem to have far less. Now, again, it's hard to make comparisons. People tell you lots of different things about these things, but it does seem to me that it is not anywhere near as straightforward as saying data retention and removing data retention would result in lots of crimes going unsolved. And since we have a lot of European states who now have no data retention laws, we don't seem to have those countries don't seem to have difficulty solving crimes. I'm still, you know, one of those is Germany, which is a large state with a lot of problems in, you know, certain areas. You know, I don't think
there's been a spike in terrorist activity there, has there?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Mm. Yeah, well, what you can see is that a lot of cases get solved maybe by this data retention, but it's different cases. So, I mean, the police might have, you know, a nice statistic of solving, like, you know, 500 cases of, you know, petty little drug dealers, but they don't actually help to solve anything else.
But
that's the thing.
But there's difference between the data retention as it was in law with the from the European and the data that they got from the providers before that already. A provider would have data. They would have to get a judge to give them a court order to say, we want this data.
Yeah.
While with the European data retention, they could just get whatever they wanted. They didn't need to get approval anymore. That's one of the reasons why it was shut down by the judge. And that makes a very big difference in how you approach this, because if you collect everything, everyone is guilty in your eyes. Well, if you are only allowed to get it when you prove that someone's guilty, it makes it a lot harder to get to that data. So there's much more checks involved in if I'm getting this data, is that person probably a criminal or not? Yeah.
I think we've had quite a long conversation there, because it's 9 o'clock, and I would like to go and have a drink. I think it's been a really enjoyable conversation, so thank you all very much. I hope you do go and talk to your candidates and generally cause them a bit of pain, in whatever ways you can manage.
There are different ways to eliminate people.
Right, thank you. I'd just like to say a few words about our chef and things are coming up. Debbie, you said you had a System 4 filming coming up.
Yeah, System 4, we're going to be doing it the week after Easter.
Okay.
So I'm putting it on the lecture theatre there, trying to encourage as many of the students that haven't seen it already to come along. So I'll send you the date and the information about it so you can...
Okay, so we'll get a note of that on the list. Also, there's a hustings in Sheffield Central on the Sunday the 19th of April. It's an open hustings, so if you can get along and do that and ask questions about surveillance and digital rights issues, that'd be appreciated. If you want to discuss questions on the mailing list, if anyone's got any questions they want to then we can have a go at discussing those as well.
Where's the hustings on the 19th?
It's at the St Timothy's Church in Broomhill. I'll post details in the list as well about that.
Great.
And there's leaflets here. There's privacy tools for Android and iPhones for encrypting text messages and phone calls. It's just how to set them up and a few leaflets and stickers and things.
And I spot some of our digital surveillance reports, which are good read as well. If you haven't had one, then do pick one up. So,
we're going to be retiring to the Rutland, so we'll see you all in there soon.
Thank you.
Thanks to Jim.